Welcome to Australian Design Radio, a podcast seeking to provide Australia and the world with conversations and commentary on design.
This episode is recorded on Yuggera and Turrbal country, and we acknowledge the traditional owners, their enduring connection to the land, knowledge and stories, paying our respects to elders past and present. I'm your host, Miley Yeomans, and I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Leach. Matt, how are you going?
I'm good. It has been a crazy few weeks with work and side projects and family, but I'm so happy we're getting these out. This one is a great one.
Yeah, this is another one that we recorded at the design conference in Brisbane. And we should say a big thank you to Matt Haynes for giving us the opportunity to sit down and speak with so many of the speakers from the conference.
Yeah, we love you, Mr. Haynes. And the next conference is coming up. Have you seen the new site?
I have. It looks really good. I've got to say I'm particularly excited about seeing Dominic and Rob from Mucho.
Yeah, they're going to be great, I'm sure. I'm actually keen to see Tara from Atlassian Design. You know, she was one of the first people we had on ADR, and Flynn and I were so green that after the interview, we realized that we hadn't even turned our mics on. Luckily, we'd recorded her perfectly, but we had to go and redo our bits, and I don't think anyone noticed. Anyway, enough about the past. Let's talk about the future. Who do we have on this episode?
So on this one, we've got Frankie Young and yourself interviewing Alastair McCready.
Ah, Alastair. Yes, he's the founder of Monolith, a typographic design practice based out of Auckland, New Zealand.
It's a pretty wide-ranging chat about awards, what type designers are like, and the momentum that you need when you're designing type.
Yeah, I really enjoyed talking with him, particularly when we got into that idea of embracing place and how where you are feeds into the work.
Definitely. All right, let's press play.
Hope you enjoy this one. This idea of kind of stepping out on your own was really strong for you. And I kind of want to dig into that because I think a lot of people, absolutely at conferences, they might be like watching something that's very different than what they do in their normal work and thinking, I want to do more of that sort of stuff. What was the decision-making process for you to step out on your own?
Well, for a little bit of context, it's probably I haven't been at full-time on my own for overly long. You know, you talk to some people and like, yeah, 10 years ago when I went on my own, it's literally like two. But I've been doing what
Annette was just on, and she talked about 40 years.
And I look forward to the day I can say that.
Yeah.
But for now, so a few factors to think about in terms of that context is recently become a dad, and we'd just come out of COVID. Well, not come out, we're still in it, aren't we? But, you know, lockdowns were still on the way, and I just managed to secure a mortgage.
Nice.
And we're moving house, and there's all sorts of stuff. But I was just waking up thinking it's time to do this thing. And I think part of that was because working as in a day job at some really amazing studios, don't get me wrong. But I didn't really feel like I had the chops to be doing that really, really well. In terms of graphic design on a commercial role.
Is that just imposter syndrome or?
I mean, there's probably elements of that. Mm. But I'm quite slow and methodical because I get caught. The things that make me great at drawing fonts make me bad at designing with them.
Yep.
Because you consider everything, you know, and that can be quite bad. So, and on top of that, I think, you know, I've been working under this moniker, Monolith, and doing my thing after hours, just draw my own fonts as you do.
Yep.
For so long, but I was struggling to just kind of, I felt like in the minds of some of the people that wanted to use these fonts, I was kind of it's cute that that's his hobby. You know, and I sort of, it's like I need to go out and improve myself with this. So it was really daunting, and obviously couldn't have done it without the support of obviously my own family, but some key figures as well, some close friends and people even I was working for. Like, you know, when I did have that conversation with, I was working at a studio called In-House, who, you know, I've looked up to for so long.
Yeah.
You know, when I was studying design, I got into designing books because I saw their work and would just, you know, that was my thing.
Mm.
And I had that conversation with them, and they were just like, yeah, that, I couldn't agree with you more there. You have to do this. And they were like, you know, they in some ways they didn't put up a fight, which is like, damn. But that's also just, I don't know, they're just really authentically supportive, you know. And so really big respect to them for having my back. And
yeah,
a lot of people, when they say, oh, he's making a go of it, people just came out of the woodwork and to give me work. Or
yeah, and it, sure I imagine that was that little push that you needed, like you're testing the waters, and they were like, yeah, that makes perfect sense.
And yeah. And since, you know, it was really fortunate that in those first few months, I was able to actually drum up more work than I thought I'd ever be able to sort of dig up. Stuff just sort of appeared, and I was really, really lucky. And even guys like Chris Sowsby, you know, New Zealand, who's, you know, the person who's put New Zealand on the map in terms of type. And I'd be getting referrals, you know, so, oh, yeah, Chris told us to talk to you. I mean, that's just so, that was so encouraging.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I just want to go back a little bit. You said you were waking up in the mornings thinking, I need to do this thing.
Mm.
What's the time period there? Was that like years of waking up thinking that, or?
I mean, it's something I think I'd known I would do. It was more, it wasn't like I need to do this. It was more like, okay, now's the time. And that was in maybe over a course of 6 months or so, just playing with the idea, but being nervous to, because I had things at stake. I mean, I had to obviously pay the bills, and I didn't want to send us all backwards now that we're bringing this our little boy into the world, and what that looked like. So it was pretty terrifying to have that conviction. And it's like, are you serious now? Like, how good would it be if this was like 3 years ago or something? But I felt like I was only really getting good enough to be able to offer the service. So
right.
It's just a matter of things all aligning at a certain time. And
Yeah. Always at the right time, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I'm fascinated by that, because I talk to a lot of people. I'm probably like this myself. It's that risk factor that you look at and you think, the risk is just too high. There's too much on the line. I'll just put this to bed for a while, and it just stays there. So I'm always fascinated by people who did the other thing. They just went, actually, now is the time, and I have to do this.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to sleep it off in a way that, you know, that there was an opportunity there to get out and make a go of things, and that I would slip away if I didn't seize it. So I just needed to get in amongst it, and you know, people were waiting for me to go and do it. So it was just, I don't know, maybe there's something deep down on you, it would be fine, but I can remember being pretty scared at the start, yeah, and just how people would receive it, you know, because it has been, like I've talked about before, about being known as the guy who does these things and then trying to sell that. I mean, there's a lot of people who are really supportive. Doesn't mean that they're going to help you, you know, pay your bills. So it's awesome. The support was fantastic, but, you know, it's another thing to drum up as turn it into work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how did you do that? Like, what, I mean, you were doing this on the side, your hobby. Did you have clients that you kind of brought in from that? Or was it starting from nothing?
A bit of both,
right,
if I'm totally honest. So, yeah, I mean, I'm living in the UK for a while, and I made a few cool connections over there. I worked at a type foundry for a while called Colophon Foundry, who, you know, that was a huge learning step for me, and still really admire those guys, and, you know, we're good friends. And I think I just sort of understand the business of type more than just being able to physically draw fonts. Is like, they're two different things. They're so opposite. And so I sort of put the word out a little bit, and we got around, and that's when certain jobs would come my way from overseas. And so for that first year, I was doing like maybe 60% of the work was from offshore, which was tough too, because, you know, you want to please people, and so they want to schedule a meeting, which means it's going to be like 2 a.m. But you just have to do it, you know. That was the only real way at it.
Yeah.
So obviously you got me going back there now. Yeah. Sort of thinking about it all. Super weird. Yeah, it was a strange time. I didn't know how people would take it, but so far it's been good. it's been all good stuff.
Oh, it's been amazing. I mean, you were awarded the Ascender Award by Type Doctors Club 2022.
Yeah.
How did that feel?
That was so reassuring, I think, in a weird way. It was like affirmation.
Yeah.
You were okay.
Yeah.
Because only because I was on that award with people I really look up to had previously got it.
Yeah.
And it was actually the last year I could have possibly entered because of the age factor. And then when they announced it, these people I literally admire and look to for inspiration were on the same list. Wow. And there's me. And then you got this awards, like this big giant mass Zoom call, basically, where everyone gets together to celebrate this win because it's people from all over the world. And I'm suddenly face to face with, you know, sign heroes. And they're like, oh, yeah, I've really liked your work for a long time. And you're thinking, I think it's a New Zealander thing. You just assume no one has any idea who you are.
Yeah.
And if they do, they assume you're a hobbit or something. Yeah. That was big. I mean, it's just that, yeah, because it's a type award by Type Minds.
Yeah.
Because I've had some nice awards in the past with local design awards, AGDA and things like that here. But they're graphic design, eh? So, you know, it takes a lot to be able to draw a typeface. So it's quite an achievement when you then enter it into a design award, like a graphic design program. It's like, wow, it's a full font. That's impressive, you know. But to type designers, it's kind of like, oh, is that it?
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
So, yeah, that was awesome. Yeah.
No, I think it's just really interesting to hear because for younger designers, you always work away. And when you get feedback from your peers or people that you look up to that actually notice your work, it's quite surreal. Mm. So I can really relate to it. I was wondering about having the courage of branching out on your own. I always thought when you said people generally go, I'm having a baby now.
Yeah, it's not the right
Let's
time.
Put it to bed. Time. I feel it can also go the other way where you go, okay, this is going to be absolutely crazy. We're creating a human and it's going to be chaos. Now it's actually a really good time to go full chaos.
Oh, because it's chaos already.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then when your child can't is small, they really just sleep and they need a lot of attention. But their needs for, you know, more clothes and everything that grows with your stature in your studio.
Yes.
So
yeah, that's true.
It might not actually be a terrible time.
I mean, the big driving thing is, and I'm so happy that it worked out, is that it was about being available, really, you know.
Yeah.
Not having to, I mean, there's jokes about Auckland traffic and those kind of things. I don't have a commute anymore. I work just down the road from where we live.
Yeah.
I jet home all the time I've helped over the last few years to, just because I can. I mean, you know, we're on the one income. And my wife is a really amazing artist and designer in her own right, is doing this thing in the current time, you know, raising this little kid. So I want to play my part, you know, and get involved and be available to them and to him. And it's just worked out so well because of it. So there's so many times you think, wow, imagine if I couldn't be available to come and help with this thing, or, you know, oh, I had to shoot off to work at this time every day and just be gone regardless of how terrible a sleep you might have had or whatever.
Yeah.
So in a way it's been the best possible thing, and I think that was probably the biggest motivating factor.
Yeah. And you do have a separate space to go to work.
Yes, yeah. So where we live is an area of Auckland called Hobsonville Point, which is people call it Pleasantville now. It's kind of like a retirement village for millennials. It's just right. Like, when we moved out there, we were like, oh, well, you know, we've got a kid on the way, so why don't we go out there. We need to upgrade the car. Let's get one of those kind of small SUVs because, you know, they're safe, right? Good ergonomics. And then I move out there and there's just a whole lot of people that look like us driving small SUVs. So you just realize, you're like, oh, no, I'm one of the masses. But it's an old Air Force base. And so for me, I never was that interested in design growing up. All I wanted to do was play guitar or fly jets, you know, from a bit of a flying family. But we don't have any jets. There's a reason the New Zealand Air Force logo is a flightless bird.
Right.
It's not something we do. And that just wasn't. So I went to art school instead. I don't know how that connection happened. But so, yeah, living on a previously what was an Air Force base that my wife's grandfather actually used to be a squadron leader at. So we look out our kitchen window and can see his old house. It's still there. And I work in the hangar that serviced the planes he used to fly. So that's now a shared workspace. And it's just down the way a little bit, a few hundred meters away. So it's all right there, and it's, you know, so I don't fly the planes, but it's probably about as close as I can get to doing that.
I guess the reason I asked, a lot of people, you know, after the pandemic and everything, they were working at home anyway, and then, you know, that's where a lot of kind of new businesses sprung up because, well, I'm here anyway, and this is my desk, and now people are kind of struggling with that kind of like the home work balance. When does one? So it was interesting you actually have a place to go to that you.
Yeah, it helps for me. Yep. If we had a bigger place to live, but if we had an extra room, you know, maybe it'd be a bit different. But it's just not an option. 2-bedroom house with, you know, with a toddler. So,
but also that, you know, you're talking about the space, and your eyes are really lighting up about this kind of history that kind of lives in that space.
Yeah.
How does that come into your work? I mean, that has to kind of affect you in some way.
Well, I mean, there's still like oil stains and stuff on the floor, and, you know, the building is a heritage structure, so they had to preserve a certain amount of it. I mean, inside it's like any workspace, feels like an office, and I don't have a huge opportunity to make it my own. I have as much as I can.
Mm.
And that won't always, one day I'll have a nice four-walled studio, I can, you know, get some more stuff up on the walls and stuff. But I think it just that connection to places has always been something that's quite important to the work I'm doing, from whether it's in Auckland or where I grew up in, you know, another area of New Zealand. It's just the ground beneath your feet is really, it feeds into the work, I think, because you know, otherwise it's there's an amazing Māori proverb about walking backwards into the future. And so it's sort of, for me, it's, I've always told people that if you want to see the future, just look to history.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sort of it speaks a lot to type design in general, because, you know, you sort of look to the work, mine the history books, mine the type specimens, and you know, that's where you see how other people have resolved things in the past, and you can work out where you need to, you know, tackle that going forward. But it's also just, I think, in terms of place, and for me, I mean, New Zealand's not an old country and on a global scale. It's like Germany, for example. We don't, there's obviously a lot of history there, but it's a different type of recorded history. It's not in books, or it's in stories, and it's, you know, in the land itself. So the way lands are shaped, or the actual physical geography is where those stories lie. So I think all of us have that sense of place quite deeply, just because that's how the culture has been.
That's something that really struck me with all the talks from the New Zealand designers.
Mm. Yeah.
This very, very strong connection to your place.
Yeah, I think it's becoming, a lot of people have been talking about it, and I think in Australia that's happening more and more. Mm. It feels like a new thing. It doesn't feel like a new thing. It's an old thing that we've remembered almost. Because, you know, go back 5 years ago, we weren't having these discussions as much.
Yeah, totally.
Why is that?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Because it seems like such a strong connection, and so it seems to come quite natural.
And it feels obvious as well. Of course, you should invest in the place you are and let that influence you and, you know, what you're doing.
I mean, no, it's totally, it's all very, I mean, when I've collaborated or worked with, or in this setting, you know, with the Australian design community and people acknowledging the land and where they stand and whose land it is. I mean, you hear that spoken out and you're like, oh, that's so wonderful. That's great that they do that. And then people on the other hand turn around and be like, oh, you Kiwis are so good at it.
Mm.
And I'm sort of thinking like, are we? You know, but I know historically in terms of like, the, you know, we've been embracing our Indigenous culture in terms of place names and, you know, changing things back to how they might have always been. But there's still a really deep culture of division, you know, in the country itself. And, it probably comes out in the creative community more of seeming that we've got things together. But, you know, recently in New Zealand, they just announced they want to add Māori words alongside
the road signs.
English and road yeah. signs. And
it's become a real political thing, hasn't
and,
it?
And there's a huge portion of New Zealand going, why?
Yeah.
You know, and saying, what do you mean? So it was always called that. And you're like, well, no, it wasn't.
Yeah.
And so it's yeah. just a, it's a funny,
and just
that dialogue
really,
still exists. You
really
know, it's
weak
not like
arguments, like it, people will be confused.
Yeah, oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't know. I mean, if you, most of the people with those opinions haven't actually
yeah.
left their four corners, you know, to
mm-hmm.
to see beyond. And, you know, if you've been fortunate enough to go traveling or see other countries, you see how they do it. That's exactly that way. People aren't dying in masses because of road accidents because they're getting confused. It's,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
totally fine. But it's just a conservative mindset, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And a general fear of change. Which again is probably another reason why you don't see it a lot in the design community, because we embrace change. That's why our job
I was
exists.
Just going to say that, yeah.
yeah.
And we learn to look at different perspectives in the other side of the argument.
Mm. Yes, yes, you're totally right. And the connection to places is run strong in New Zealand, I think. But I would say not on all facets of
yeah.
the way the country operates.
I noticed on your biography you had writer as well. Is that something that Monolith, is that part of Monolith?
Well, the whole thing started, Monolith was actually the name of a student project I did in 2015. It was my first sort of dive into this idea of monuments. And,
yeah.
And I produced that book around, you know, called Type as Monument. And
yeah.
It wasn't a university project, really, but I don't throw that out because a lot of people are just like, where can I get a copy of it? And I was like, well, there aren't any.
Yeah.
Obviously, I've made a few of them, but it's the plan was always to rewrite it and publish it because it's very academic. It's very, you know, it's not a lovely piece of writing. So I've contributed articles to blogs, and when I was at university, some friends and I, we put together a few publications we got funding for, and it was like, you know, I've done plenty of writing.
Mm.
And obviously use draw words on a daily basis. I like the idea of being able to use them to craft the language.
Yeah.
But again, it takes me a long time to write a nice piece of text and avoid the, you know, temptation to get AI onto it.
Yep.
But I think, yeah, that to me it's storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't go around saying I love storytelling in my work and not be able to actually tell a story if I have to as well.
Yeah, but yeah. There's not many... Well, maybe there is, and you might, you know, say that I'm completely wrong, but I haven't met many typographers who are also writers.
No, that's a good point. Neither have I.
Mm.
it's funny, you go to, yeah, I've been to plenty of conferences overseas, you know,
yep.
living over there, you know, type talks and all that kind of stuff, and yeah, it's, the type community is pretty broad, especially in that part of the world, and just the loveliest people, but they're all quite insular, you know, and there's not a lot of extroverts, what it would feel. Maybe I'm wrong, I'm not sure. But even down in this part of the world, the type designers I know are quite outgoing and
Oh right. Okay.
Yeah, and there's a bit quite a strong connection of community, and when you're together they often don't actually want to talk about type, they want to talk about just life in general, families and all that kind of stuff. So it's a funny, maybe it's a conference versus just daily life, but
yeah, and I guess the conference does pull out more extroverted people.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, no, it's an interesting, because, you know, when you talk about typographers, it's that idea of patience and attention to detail and being able to kind of keep coming back to something that kind of, you know, a lot of other people would be like, oh my God, I've spent so much time on this.
Yeah.
And just they miss that final mile.
Now, type designers as a whole, I think, are just really deep thinking people, and there's a lot to say, and they can talk about their work really, really well, and design rationale of things and the thinking and the process, and it's, you know, it's really wonderful to read, but sometimes there's an absence of storytelling in that because it's quite methodical.
Yeah.
So the writing part for me is more about the creative aspect to it, and
this
sense of connection to place and product and all that kind of stuff, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, cool. Now, here I am worrying and waffling on.
No, not at all.
No, it's so interesting. And I think this, the storytelling element of type, because I think a lot of us only think of type design, of you just slaving away what were the forms, and then defining all the glyphs and not really seeing the poetry in the craft of actually shaping those letter forms.
I mean, you definitely, when you're designing a type, when you go to put it out into the world and you influence too hard what it should be or what it's made to do, or you know, you can sort of stunt its growth.
Right.
Because you want designers to see it and go, I could use that for this.
Yeah.
Not kind of, this is a font made for that, so I'm not doing that at the moment, so I'm not going to, you know. So storytelling is one thing, but it's kind of like, it's almost like a weird sort of sales pitch. It's like, imagine if, you know, as opposed to this is for this.
Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of new font technology is pretty, you know, can be used for that, like the variable font thing. Everyone's wondering what is this really good for, though?
You know,
other than just another flashy thing. When I think graphic designers have a lot of paralysis over choosing typefaces in general.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So what, do you want to make it even harder for people?
Yeah.
But there's an aspect there, you can tell a story with it if you, you know, sort of can find the right context. So I think it's an important tool to practice when you're using typefaces.
But I think that's an interesting point you brought up, that I always wonder, you know, as a brand designer, we design things and we always envisage a particular shelf life for our products and the ideal customer. How is that for you with type? You said that you design it and you don't want to really put it into a particular niche, but you create a typeface and then create a story in your head of what book it could possibly be in, or in which exhibition. You just make up little secret stories for your typefaces?
Maybe, yeah, probably without realizing it. But I mean, often the starting point is not a piece of, not from a genre. Oh, I'm going to look at this. I want to draw a, you know, a sort of traditional grotesque sort of type. It's usually more like I've seen something and it sparked a little idea, and so immediately that idea is linked to that. That thing, I might say, yeah, I don't get a lot of inspiration from new things, say in a gallery setting. It's more from, say, a museum, and it sometimes doesn't have anything to do with type or whatever. It could just be a sculptural form, and you're just like, oh, and that kicks off a story in there of maybe an overarching theme in the work. And so you go and look for a genre that might help tell that theme or that story better. But then I think towards the end of the drawing process, you need to kind of ease off from that story a little bit and make sure it's a functional product for people to then take and
apply. It begins the process, but then I guess as you kind of, you know, as you were speaking before, the idea of if you love something, let it go kind of thing, let it become its own thing.
I mean, obviously you'll always, I mean, some of the best use of a lot of typefaces out there you see are from the designers themselves, right?
Right.
So I think those things are always going to be the case, but then people will surprise you, and, you know, talk to a lot of type designers who say that, and they're like, hey, I never imagined it being used in that way or in this setting, but what you've done is just appropriate. It's really, really cool. So I'd like to do more with that. I mean, I haven't launched too much of my own work. I'm too busy drawing them for companies, and that's a whole different process, right? But I do have stuff in the works, and it's, you know, taking shape based on that. And then sometimes it gets parked, gets put in the drawer, and you don't look at it again until something reminds you of it, which ultimately influences the origin point, and then things start to shift and change in the design. And so sometimes you just got to let them do their thing, and sort of they almost design themselves if you give it enough time.
I do, like, someone else was talking about, the idea of revisiting old work, and particularly with typography, it's a big job. It's like you have to kind of really go back into it, back to where you were. So it's interesting that that's something you look forward to?
I mean, I think a lot of design is based on kind of these moments of, these bursts of energy, you know, like a binge on a type for a couple of days, and then just like it's feeling really good, and then something naturally will come along and you need to just shift your focus for a while, and then you come back to it and you either love it or you hate it.
Yeah.
Or you think, what was I thinking? And, you know, it's, yeah, it's just like, it's like that with any creative process, I suppose. But specific to fonts, it's quite a visual thing. And, like, I've drawn ones that work well with some settings, text settings. Like, they work surprisingly well, say, in Te Reo Māori, which only actually only uses just around, just under half of the what we know as the A to Z.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And those shapes are particularly beautiful, so it's not hard to make Māori language look really draw and look really cool.
Yeah.
But then you try and set some sort of long form text in Latin or something, and the word yacht comes along or something really gross, and you're just like, oh, it's terrible. What am I thinking? So I don't know. It does depend on maybe the mindset and the lens you're looking at it through. Yeah. What colored glasses you put on that day, that kind of thing.
In the talk that you gave at the design conference in Brisbane, you talked about this idea of the sort of spectrum as like kind of leading your process. Can you kind of reiterate or go back through that?
Yeah, what I've sort of learned from working in the design industry as well as going and doing my own thing is that, again, that idea of paralysis with fonts, I think part of that is just because people understand what's working and they relate it to an idea and then they apply that to a job as opposed to thinking, how can I best tell the story and apply what's the right design to help tell that story. So there's that notion and type of, you know, being reductive and being recessive, getting out of the way and letting the design speak. And some people do that really, really well. And so that's perfect in some scenarios, like a gallery. But for me, being a lover of history, I'd go around and see sort of a heritage scenario and someone representing this was once the site of this, and there's a plaque.
Mm-hmm.
And they've set it in like Times New Roman or something, and you're just like, that is such a missed opportunity to help add to that. And they're trying almost this, or on the opposite end, they've gone too far the other way and they've gone really decorative and just thinking like, because this is old, so I'm going to look an old looking font, you know. And they've chosen, like, you know, there's an image next to an image of something from the 1920s, and they're using like some sort of neon thing from the 70s because it's old, right? It's all old. And it's just not for me that. That just drove me up the wall. So for me, a lot of the work I do is really just sometimes finding a point on a line of on a big spectrum, rather than thinking of black and white. It's sort of like the grey area of how much tone you want this type to take, how much personality does it need?
Yeah, okay.
What's the context for it? And yeah, I even do that in just the way I represent my own work. I've got a holding page at the moment, but this idea of a slider, because I come into a usually on a bespoke job, I come into the mix a bit later on. I'm not from the outset, so if I come in the middle, there's a process before and there's a process that comes after. And
yep.
Sort of, this just idea of being comfortable in the grey area. And sometimes you don't really know which direction you're heading, so you just sort of have to try and find a way forward, find a map.
Yeah, because I was going to ask, how do you visualise that in the sense, like, is it like a map or is it... Or is it more like a kind of like a crime scene kind of investigation?
It can be, yeah. That would be really... I think sometimes that's where sketching can help. Like, I'm not a big drawer. I find it's time consuming, and I'm, like, my brain's going faster than my hands can go. But that can be a really cool way just to quickly get something out. And then obviously when you show that to a client, they love it, you know, sketching away, and like, oh, look at this guy go. But it's not really true to the process as much as people might think, not in a typical brand sort of logo design process or something where you're just putting trying to make interesting connections types sort of quite component based, and it can be really distracting if you're trying to draw a word with multiple versions of the same letter and then they all look different and it starts to get a bit weird. So finding a way forward is about finding the source.
Yeah.
Finding the origin point of where you're coming from, trying to map roughly where you need to go, like, you know, in terms of that context of the line, the spectrum of, is it, how far neutral is it or how far gestural is it? And then bouncing between those two things for long enough until what you've done is working. Does that answer?
Yeah, it does. It's really making me think about I mean, you said a lot of things there, which really, I guess, shows your character a little bit more, because, you know, we just talked about how type needs to be patient and deep and slow, but then you also talked about sketching, that your brain is going too fast for your hand.
Mm.
So I'm kind of interested in how you marry those two things, that deep and slow and patient side of you, but also this kind of really fast brain that is kind of working through things.
I don't know. I have I work on multiple screens.
Oh, right.
And I have a lot of stuff up, sort of helping guiding the bounce between.
Yeah.
So it's not just like one Mac with a window open and I'm drawing away.
Sometimes. I don't know how anyone works on one screen.
No, I mean, I know people not that anymore, do, and they do beautiful stuff. And I'm like, oh, good power to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, that's like turning your head. I mean, you see those new glasses that Apple have just dropped.
Oh, yeah.
You can set up multiple monitors. Next thing you know, you'd be in like some sort of financial center and you're just sort of gazing around. But
I'm looking at monitor 96 at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's, I don't know, there can be too much as well, too much information. And I have to usually turn my notifications off or close my email down and stuff during a deep working sort of time where you need to get stuff done. You end up on a trajectory, right? And you're just like, you're starting a coast and you're feeling really good. And then your phone will go off and you're out of that. So type can be like that. You need that. It's really hard to just stop, start and actually do any work with type, because it's about the momentum. And often I tell people it's about the time you take away from it that actually influences it. So
right, and that's what you're sort of talking about, coming back to things. And
Yeah. Not that, like, it, you know, it's not that way with necessarily a bespoke job, but if you're attached to something and you're feeling, you know, emotionally invested in it, you do need to let it stop. Otherwise, I think it just ends up becoming a version of itself it was kind of not meant to be, and you force it into something. Yeah. Because I think it's with any idea, right? Would you agree? It's sort of just...
Yeah, you don't want to get to a point where you put too much of yourself in it, because you become so invested that you can't keep the actual intent
in mind. Yeah, and you're so desperately trying to visualize this thing in your mind, but I think maybe your own mind is, like you say, moving too fast or to make sense of it yet, so you need to park it. It sounds all very conceptual. Like, I get it. It's quite a first world problem to have, right? Sometimes you just got to put the work in, but yeah. I mean, there's been plenty of scenarios of times where people have been expecting something from me to use, you know, have you got anything I could use for this? Oh, yeah, I do. I've got something in the works. And when I say that, but I've actually like only drawn half of it.
Yeah.
And see, just like bust it out, you know. But, you know, usually you wouldn't say it. Yeah, it's good for it if it wasn't ready. So, yeah, don't get me wrong.
Mm.
You can move quickly with fonts. It's just sometimes good ideas take a while to really be the best versions of themselves.
So it sounds like you kind of work in a way that, like, new ideas are always coming and you're capturing those in some way and kind of moving them to a certain point until they're kind of really needed for something in particular.
Yeah, I have a couple of genres I'm trying to unpack, and maybe usually different things at the same time. Sometimes polar opposites, so that you have that a decent break from one so you can jump on another.
Yeah.
And there's this one type I've been drawing for ages, just for myself to use. Is like kind of like a brand font, and it's taken a lot of different shapes and forms over the years, and it even at one point totally got hijacked and went into a different project and became a brand type for that project.
Oh, really?
For a book. And so it's out there.
Yeah.
And so that caused me to sit back and think, okay, but that wasn't the version I wanted it to be anyway. Right. So that's fine, it works well for that, it's fine, it's awesome. It's back on track. Where was I? And it's changed a lot again. It'll probably continue to change some more. Some of it's used, I think Matt's been using for the design conference branding.
Yep.
Yeah, all those are all kind of unfinished sort of types that are, you know, they had all the characters are all there, it's all there, but they're not, in my mind, they weren't ready to for your larger project. But, you know, that design conference or TDC, they look all right.
Yeah,
they do. Yeah, and you know, as long as the other people at the other end are happy, that's obviously another factor. Because it's one thing to give them work, just because you've given it to them doesn't mean they should use it, right?
Yeah.
It has to be appropriate for their vision. So it's a journey, eh?
And there you go. I hope you enjoyed that.
Yeah, I know I did. It really covered a lot.
He was so easy to talk to. And I saw that play out during the whole conference. He was so happy to talk to everyone and anyone.
It's one of the things I really love about the conference. There's so few barriers between the audience and speakers.
Yeah, you know, you're exactly right. It's just a bunch of creatives catching up and inspiring each other.
Exactly. And we are super excited to hear your thoughts about the episode and the podcast in general. Please let us know what you liked, what you want to hear more of, or who you'd like to see us interview. You can reach out on hello@ozdesignradio.com.
And if reaching out to us directly feels a little too forward for you, you could leave us a 5-star review on Spotify or iTunes.
You sure could. In fact, I think that you should. But either way, we will be with you next week.
See you then.
Bye.